This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on, why a new overtime proposal is a win for working women.
But first, what we are seeing today is not a Haitian crisis. It's not a Dominican crisis, City Councilman Matthew Eugene said. It is a human rights crisis. This is discrimination. Councilman Eugene came together with an expansive coalition to condemn the looming expulsions by the Dominican Republic of Haitian immigrants, including those born there, which is when he made that statement.
The current crisis has its roots in a 2013 court ruling that stripped the citizenship of persons born in the Dominican Republic whose parents weren't Dominican citizens. An estimated 460,000 Haitian migrants live in the Dominican Republic, which shares the Caribbean island of Hispaniola with Haiti. Mimi spoke with the organizers and participants in the marching with the Coalition for Human Rights for people of Haitian ancestry in the Dominican Republic.
I'm at Grand Army Plaza with a significant coalition of organizations and individuals, workers and community activists, demanding that the Dominican government must stop the expulsion, deportation process and end the legal racism and discrimination against Haitians and Dominicans of Haitian descent. They are preparing to march across the Brooklyn Bridge to the steps of City Hall, part of an international campaign to end apartheid in the Dominican Republic. I am here with one of the organizers who can explain precisely what the nature of this march is about.
My name is Nancy Morisseau. I'm a board member of the Haitian American Lawyers Association of New York. We're part of the Coalition for Human Rights in the Dominican Republic. It's a broad-based group of people who came together in 2015 in response to the human rights violations happening in the Dominican Republic to black people, and in particularly to people of Haitian descent. Our message is one of human rights, that the 2013 court decision that stripped citizenship from over 210,000 Dominicans of Haitian descent is a violation of their human rights. Our message is twofold. One is for the Dominican government to return citizenship from everyone from whom it was taken and to follow due process guidelines and follow international laws for removing people from the country. Right now, there's a huge population of people who allegedly self-deport, but our feedback from what's going on the ground is that they were intimidated, coerced, threatened at night, and were made to leave. And the anecdotal evidence is clear. If you have about 60,000 people who within less than 2 months landed on the Haitian side of the border. That speaks volumes. We're asking the Dominican government to exercise humane treatment of people of Haitian descent in the Dominican Republic, and we're asking for the Obama administration to really speak on this issue and use all of its political, economic, and diplomatic leverage to make sure that changes happen. If people want to support, we're asking them to petitionswhitehouse.gov and search for Dominican human rights, and they can sign onto the petition. We need to get 100,000 signatures before August 25th. The Obama administration would only speak on this issue after they receive 100,000 signatures. So we want to show that there is a broad-based group of individuals in America, American citizens, who are interested about what is happening in their own backyard. 210,000 people are now stateless, meaning that they are not recognized by any country. It is the largest stateless population in the Western Hemisphere, and it's in our backyard.
And I see you're pointing to a woman here with a Dominican flag who I understand is of Dominican descent as well.
Yes.
Maybe you can help us understand what is happening with the Dominican government that is taking this stance for the deportation of Haitians of Dominican, some of them, born in the Dominican Republic and also have lived there for probably as much of a generation.
My name is Arelis Figueroa. I'm from the Latino Ministry at the Riverside Church. This is a very complicated, sensitive issue with a long history between the two countries. of hatred, misunderstanding, but also political gain. The Haitian issue has been used by different governments in the Dominican Republic to have the attention of the people focused on that issue, not in the important issue like corruption.
Is this an issue of national chauvinism in the Dominican Republic to whip up support for an election that is shortly going to commence?
It is part of that. They just changed the constitution one more time in the Dominican Republic, and nobody's talking about that. People are focusing on this issue and this whole nationalism. Dominican and Haitian have lived together for a long time, and on the ground, and people having always solidarity among the two people. But the government have always used that issue to divide us, to tell us that we are not black, even though we are black, that the Haitians are the black. That have been playing in the mind of the people for a long time. You remember since the time of Trujillo, where things get really, really out of control.
The purpose of the march, what would you like to communicate as to what you would like to see happen with the American elected officials here to support the Haitians of Dominican ancestry, many of them, the Haitians who are living in the Dominican Republic and fighting against deportation?
We want human rights. We recognize the right of every country to regulate their immigration, and that is fine. As long as you respect human rights, don't discriminate because of color, race, even sexual orientation. We see over there that in the regulation process, why we just seeing the Haitians and black in the line, when we know there is a lot of other people from other countries who live in the Dominican Republic, and they are able to fix their status and complete all the process with all these problems.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nancy, what would you suggest the hardships that would be endured and the injustices if indeed the Haitians who are living on the Dominican part of the island are subject to deportation?
There are two sets of populations affected. There's the Haitian migrants, and there's children who are born in the country who are Dominicans of Haitian descent. And the Dominican Republic, when they're forcibly removing people, they're not making a distinction. So what you have now, the migrant workers were invited to the Dominican Republic to work pursuant to treaties between Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and they do the great deal of the jobs that most of the people in the Dominican Republic do not do. So they've been there for living there for decades. If they're forced to be moved out, they're going to lose their homes, their friends, their families, their bank accounts. They're going to go to Haiti when they have not lived in Haiti for a number of years. Their children don't have any understanding of Haiti. They only speak Spanish, and all their friends and family, their livelihood. And then, right, we're not sure what's happening on the border. We don't know how they will be deported, where they're going to be deported to, or what's going to happen when they get there. Currently, you see the images coming from the border. They're shantytown. People living in makeshift boxes in squalid situations. It's very important that we show today solidarity with people of Haitian descent and migrant people all over the world. You know, this is, there's an anti-migrant sentiment all over the world, including the United States. Every person of immigrant background, whether you're Asian, Latin, Caribbean, European, but your family came here for an opportunity. You should understand why the purpose of the people going to the Dominican Republic is as well.
And why do you think the Obama administration has not spoken out against this? And there are New York congressmen like Charles Rangel, who certainly have not risen to the occasion of supporting the Haitian people in this struggle.
I don't know why the Obama administration hasn't spoken on this. That is why we're out here saying the U.S. can't remain silent. The U.S. is the largest trading partner, the Dominican Republic. The U.S. funds CES Front, which is the border patrol on the Dominican side. So we're funding the people who are actually executing these deportations. We need to really speak on this. In terms of Congress, Congresswoman Clark, Congressman Meek, Congressman Kennedy, Congresswoman Wilson. There's a number of individuals who have spoken on this, and we're asking the United States Congress to also take a resolution denouncing this atrocity and human rights violation.
Nancy, thank you again.
Okay.
Thank you for speaking with us. Well, we have a brother here. He's wearing a sign that says, elect Jean-Claude Senon, Boston City Councilor. You're here from Boston. Why are you in Brooklyn now getting ready to march across the Brooklyn Bridge on this issue? And who are you, sir?
Well, my name is Jean-Claude Senon. I am a politician in Boston, and I'm running for District 5 City Council. I'm here because, number one, it has been a unification of one island that is being dismantled right now because there's a very great humanitarian crisis. It's a shame on our government here for not opening any discussion at all on this issue and has never said anything at all about it. So I would urge President Barack Obama to really address this issue. And there's so much that has been gone in the past, and they have remained silent about it. And I think that they're waiting for the bloodshed to really take place before they could do anything about it. It's embarrassing for our government, and I'm here to tell the Dominicans it's time for them to unite, because they got to remember where we came from. Together, we brought this island that they are cherishing, a piece of it that we are also cherishing. We fought, we bled for it. I don't think there should ever be any issue as far as deportations of anyone at all or whatsoever. And for a rule to be going back to 1929 to deport folks that was born there, that's a shame.
Tell us more about the 1929 legislation that is being used as a basis for this current crisis of potential deportation of the Haitians residing on the Dominican side of the island.
It's a decision to go retrospective, way back to find out whether any of the Haitians that were born in there, whether they were of parents of Haitian origins, which is a very big issue. So if they are, they are subject to deportations. If they cannot prove that they do have the proper documents. And back then in 1929, Dominican Republic was as chaos as Haiti was. So documentation was probably the hardest thing for anybody to find. If you're asking folks right now to look at documents way back then, you're calling for an atrocity. And for you to be demanding anything as such, I could understand that you have helped the Haitians with the earthquake and you're asking those who are not legal to go back, just like they're doing here in the United States. But asking Haitians that came in here, that was born in here, and for them to prove, number one, that they have the proper documentations, and number two, to dare saying to them that they are no longer Americans anymore.
You mentioned the earthquake. How would you describe the condition of the Haitians after these years of earthquake? Has there been any meaningful reclamation of the lives and betterment of the conditions of the Haitians after the 2010 earthquake?
There are so many records out there that have justified that it has been a total failure, both from the NGOs, and it's a shame, again, for the United States when you're looking at the issue of the Red Cross. When you're looking at, you have sent down Bill Clinton together with Mr. Bush to make sure that the money was properly spent, and you've seen the result on the media lately. It's a shame. It's an outcry. This is an issue that may even affect Hillary Clinton in her role as far as attempting to become the next president. So the result is awful. Surely they were blaming the Haitian government before, saying that we were not going to be able to manage all of this money. Here they came. They did even worse than we did. So who is the culprit, really? Is it the Haitians? Or is it all the NGOs and all the Super 8 government who are throwing money in return? They're taking it back home with them.
Well, thank you very much for speaking to us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And we were marching with the Coalition for Human Rights for People of Haitian Ancestry in the Dominican Republic, and did so in a rather sweltering day over the Brooklyn Bridge to the steps of City Hall. Well, for months, we've heard that the economy is finally moving in the right direction, except for one hitch. Working people's wages, particularly those of women, are not going up. One big reason: for years, millions of workers have clocked in more and more hours without ever seeing overtime pay.
Too many workers, most of them are women, are watching their finances be stretched to the limit because even though they work overtime, they are not compensated for the work they do.
Now, why a new overtime proposal is a win for working women, says Kristen Rowe Finkbeiner, an award-winning author, co-founder and executive director of Moms Rising. And it's nice to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, let us begin by outlining the issue of the overtime question and possibly the distinction between overtime and whether we're also talking about time and a half. What actually are the parameters of that discussion as it relates to women's wages?
Right now, people are not qualified to necessarily have overtime pay if they make more than about $24,000 a year. The Department of Labor has proposed increasing the overtime salary threshold to be $50,440. That means if you make anything under $50,440, then you would be qualified for overtime pay. The analysis that Moms Rising did with the Institute of Women's Policy Research found that in 2014, if this had passed, 21.5 million workers may become eligible who are not eligible before, and the majority of those workers, as you noted, are women.
Why is that happening? Why is it that salary cutoff above which people may be denied overtime pay?
Well, this is an outdated policy that we're looking at. $24,000 a year is not enough for a family of four to live above the poverty level. And this overtime regulation hasn't, in fact, been updated since the first Bush was president. So it's a long overdue update. What's happening in America right now and why this is impacting a lot of women is that women are 50% of the labor force for the first time in history. But a lot of our public policies and regulations haven't caught up to that yet. So updating this outdated overtime standard is part of what we need to do to make a better America for all of us.
Now, you said 50% of women for the first time in history are part of the workforce. Do you have any sense of what number of those are also minimum wage workers? And then if you can also just begin to drill down on how this issue really does affect the wage and the way people are able to live.
Our labor force has changed. And when we talk about 50% of the labor force being women for the first time in history, what that means is we have also a tremendous amount of moms in the labor force. Three quarters of moms are in the labor force, and 82% of women in America do have children by the time they're 44 years old. What that also means is that when we look at our economy as a whole, and that was a terrific question, the part of our economy that's growing is actually low-wage jobs, minimum wage jobs. And two-thirds of minimum wage workers are, in fact, women. So the majority of minimum wage workers are women, which makes this overtime regulation, the increasing the threshold by which you can actually earn overtime, critically important, particularly because we have a crisis in our nation when it comes to raising families. Having a baby is now a leading cause of poverty spells in our nation. And in fact, child care costs more than college. Now, why does that matter in relation to overtime regulations? Well, one of the things that happens is that a lot of women are working hard, they're playing by the rules, and they're working beyond their 40 hours a week and getting zero pay. Well, guess what? Child care facilities do not care if you're getting paid or not for the extra hours work, and the after hours child care costs are even more than regular child care costs. So we have a lot of stories coming in from people across the country. Like one mom, Sherry, she wrote in to say that she stopped being paid overtime and being offered comp time and was told that the industry standard was to work 60 hours a week in her job, even though she was only getting paid 40 hours a week. And they wanted her to stay late past daycare hours and to work major holidays. And her pay went down and her work hours increased. Because of this, she had to hire a nanny because her daycare center wouldn't have the kids there after hours. And the nanny then ate up even more of her pay. She said she was coming home too exhausted to take her son to Cub Scouts or to do anything else for that matter. And it wasn't making sense. And she was upset that the workplace was robbing her children of their mother and her of her pay. So she said it was way too much. And it's women like her that are going to be most positively helped by the raise in the overtime threshold.
So if the employer designates a worker for any reason as being, for any number of hours as being supervisory or management, they can say that they can work almost unlimited hours past 40 hours for no additional pay at all. Is that correct? And therefore, with the number of hours they're working, they might even be getting minimum wage?
Absolutely. We hear stories about that all the time. You know, for example, if somebody's working in a donut store and they're given the title of manager or supervisor and no increase in pay, but then are told they have to work extra hours past their 40 hours and not get any overtime pay. So in fact, what ends up happening is people are working extra hours for no pay at all. And that is hopefully going to end. The comment period on this particular Department of Labor regulation is open through September 4th. People are making comments across the country. We know for a fact over 10,000 moms and dads have already put in their comments, and people can continue to put in comments of support through September 4th. This issue is catching fire online, and we've seen tons of moms and dads and working people tweeting and putting Facebook posts up in support of this policy. And, you know, we can talk about the numbers. You know, over 20 million people could be positively impacted by this. And those numbers are in this study. But what we're seeing in real life is a lot of real people, real moms, real dads, really excited about this, because too many people are living the nightmare reality of working hours and getting no pay at all.
Now, this threshold hasn't been changed since 1975, when Gerald Ford was president. Is there something in the current proposals that'll update it to take account of inflation?
I haven't seen that part of the proposal yet, and this, again, isn't finalized. So I'm personally hoping that it is not something we have to fight to update each year. And I think you're on to the exact correct line of thinking that, you know, we have kind of a national emergency going on here. Our nation, we work more hours in our nation than pretty much most other countries in the world, studies are showing. And we shouldn't have people continuously working extra hours for zero pay. A couple moms also write in and tell us about the importance of the overtime pay they are getting. And one mom wrote, her name is Allison, she wrote, quote, "Meat is so expensive that on a regular basis I struggle to purchase just beans, rice, and onions for dinner. I know that sounds strange, but the cost of having a regular phone, paying for electricity and gas to get to and from work, means that I must pick and choose what I will purchase next. Heaven forbid one of my children rips their pants or we run out of toilet paper. Overtime pay is our only way of trying to catch up. Forget about getting ahead." So we have a lot of families on the edge, and this overtime pay will help those families on the edge. And I might add, it's also going to help our economy. We forget often that we have sort of quietly moved from a manufacturing economy to a consumer-based economy, where 72% of our GDP is based on consumer spending. That means that when parents, when moms, when dads, when people, when women don't have money to spend at the grocery store in their local community, that actually we have a negative ripple effect in the whole economy. We need to make sure that everyone has the ability to put food on the table and a roof over their head when they're working hard and are in the labor force.
Clearly, moms in the workforce constitute a quiet revolution. But in this case, I wouldn't say that they've been so quiet. I know that you've gotten over 128 million impressions on Twitter, and I think that is a phenomena in and of itself. And I do want you to talk a bit about why you think this has that level of popularity, and maybe peel away some of the layers to this issue and the use of social media, which was clearly most effective in this context.
It's been really inspiring to see the number of people who have been engaged in the conversation around the need to update our overtime regulations. And even I have been shocked by the sheer numbers of people who are engaged. One of the things that's going on is really a quiet revolution in how we are experiencing media. Right now, each individual person with a Twitter account, with a Facebook account, they can actually be their own very mini media outlet. And you can come together and have conversations in ways that we haven't been able to before as a nation. So It's safe to say that moms and dads and even elected officials were talking about this overtime regulations on social media before even the Wall Street Journal picked it up. And so we really see in this way a real needed change in policy being brought forward by people who are outside the Beltway, breaking the Beltway bubble in a way that is important for the future of our democracy.
Well, this change in regulations will help millions of workers. I'm just wondering whether there's other things that Moms Rising, your organization, is looking at, which you work on also.
We are multitaskers, I will have to tell you. Moms are excellent multitaskers.
Isn't that the way it is?
Yes. So we are also, in fact, working on increasing access to affordable child care. You know, parents need safe, enriching places for their kids to be so they can work, and kids need safe, enriching places to be so they can thrive. We're working on making sure that everybody has access to paid family leave after a new baby arrives. This is a policy that every other industrialized nation in the world has in place, but we don't yet. Only 12% of people have access to that policy in the U.S. We're also working to make sure that everybody has access to the ability to earn sick days when they get sick. It's ridiculous. Right now we're talking about the huge percentage of low-wage workers who are women and moms. And in fact, 80% of low-wage workers don't have access to a single paid sick day. 40% of all private sector workers don't. So we have an emergency there as well. We're also working on making sure everybody has the ability to have healthy food. A little-known fact is that about 1 in 5 kids are living in food-insecure households in the United States of America. So making sure everybody has access to healthy food is actually quite a big deal. We're working on health care and the implementation of the Affordable Care Act and the protection of the Affordable Care Act in Medicaid and Medicare and CHIP. And we're also working on racial justice and equity. We hear from our members that no mother, no father should have to worry that a loved one could come to harm at the hands of those charged with protecting them. So we're working on ending police brutality and ending racial profiling, as well as immigration policy reform so that all families are treated fairly. So it sounds like a wide agenda, but really it's about the whole family, the whole person, the whole mom. We're also working on fair pay. Little side fact, being a mom is now a greater predictor of direct wage and hiring discrimination than being a woman is. All of these issues fit together. We have over 1 million members. We have members in every state in the nation.
We're going to have to add to those members by telling people how they can get in touch. And I wish that all that you mentioned was part of the platform of the presidential candidates. How do people get in touch with your splendid organization?
Go to www.momsrising.org. And in fact, we do have a platform for presidential candidates. So when you go there, you can get involved in making sure that happens too.
We really want to thank you for all the important work. You still have time to make sure we want this overtime and time and a half. We want this rules change to deal with the at least 20 million people affected. Kristen Rowe Finkbeiner, award-winning author, co-founder, and executive director of MomsRising.org. Thank you so much for joining us. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.